Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host on the New Books Network with the Van Leer Jerusalem series on ideas. We're very pleased to have Alexander Kay on the show today to talk about his important new book, The Invention of Jewish Theocracy, The Struggle for Legal Authority in Modern Israel. Alexander Kay is the Carl, Harry, and Helen Stoll Assistant Professor of Israel Studies at Brandeis University. Alexander Kay, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much.
Let's get right into the book because it's got some very important perspectives and understandings of an extremely contemporary issue. First, is the tension between religion and secular authorities unique to Israel?
Most definitely not. And even if we make the conversation, the question more complicated, still the answer is that it's not unique. I suppose what I mean by making it more complicated is that one of the things that I tried to do in my book, and I think that many scholars of religion today and also just contemporary history are working on, is to complicate these ideas of the secular and the religious. These are categories that are very much in flux and the boundaries are not clear between them. But in contemporary sort of everyday parlance, it's very common to talk about this tension between something which is called religious and something which is called secular. And in that respect, I think Israel is very much not unique. I mean, I'm currently living in the United States. I teach at Brandeis University. And in America, this question of a tension between religious and secular ideas is one of the sort of burning questions of the day in a very, very contentious political atmosphere. And the same goes for many countries, including other countries in the Middle East, where since the end of the colonial period, there's been all kinds of conflicts between local political movements, ideological movements that have very strongly secularist principles and those with more religious or religiously fundamentalist principles. So Israel's definitely not unique in this respect, but the way that these questions and the way that these ideas play out in Israel obviously has a unique spin, just like the other countries do as well.
Well, tell us a little about those categories, religious and secular. Do you see them as opposites, at different points on a continuum? Is the struggle between them necessarily a zero-sum game in your view?
Well, I think the complication between the categories comes from the fact that neither of those words has a really solid definition. There have been all kinds of theorists. Jose Casanova is one of the main theorists who's tried to struggle with the meaning of the word secular. It seems to apply to all kinds of different things. Does it mean something about belief? You know, is it that a secular belief is one that doesn't have a role for God, whereas a religious belief does have a role for God? Is it something about the way that societies are structured? So for example, one might call, let's say, contemporary America a secular society, and meaning that even though many people have religious beliefs, the structure of society and the structure of political institutions is such that religious beliefs are privatized rather than sort of mobilized in public. Although in America, even there, that's very much far from a simple thing. So the term secular has all these complicated aspects to it. And the term religious also, I mean, what do we mean when we say, when we talk about religion? Is it just a question of a belief in some kind of metaphysics to do with God? Is it a system of values? Is it an adherence to a particular political position? And of course, all of these things, maybe you may say yes or no to any one of those different kinds of definitions in both directions. What I think when it comes to religion in political life is that religious and secular approaches to politics are very often held up as directly opposing each other, or as a zero-sum game, as you put it. And the way these categories are thought about to come to that conclusion is something like this. The argument might go that secular politics, certainly secular democratic politics, maintains that the source of authority, the source of political sovereignty in a state, is the people. That's the definition of secular authority, of democratic authority, that the source of authority is in the people. Whereas a religious approach to politics would maintain that the source of political authority, like all authority, not just political, but also legal, also moral, is God and not the people at all. And by that definition, it does seem that there's a zero-sum game between these two different positions. They each have an answer to what is the source of authority, and that answer is different. But I actually think that underlying that apparent difference is a similarity that underpins both positions. And that similarity is something that's a product of the particular ways that modern politics has unfolded in the past couple of hundred years.
Well, since you mentioned the United States, the separation of church and state is an important principle there. And that assumes a Christian, specifically a Protestant, notion of religion as private and personal. Nevertheless, even in America and in European countries as well, who would think of themselves as secular, Christmas, for example, remains a legal holiday, which Christmas is a religious holiday. So would you say that religion, law, and politics are inevitably intertwined?
Oh, of course. I definitely do think that that's the case, certainly with certainly when it comes to politics today. I mean, it's true that, as you said, in America, the separation of church and state is an important principle. And many Americans think that that's somehow absolutely fundamental. But of course, the term separation of church and state, or religion and state, doesn't appear in the Constitution. The term comes from a letter that Jefferson wrote. But it wasn't really mobilized as a legal principle until the middle of the 20th century. And before that, it was considered consistent to have judges quoting Christian scripture as in American courts, and other aspects of a deep intertwinement between religion and public life that didn't seem inconsistent with the First Amendment of the Constitution. So even in countries like America, where there is this principle, it plays out differently in different historical periods. And I would add one more thing, which is that this isn't just a case of sort of historical accident. So the example that you brought up was a great example. America claims to have the separation between church and state, but you know, Christmas is a federal holiday, and so on. And that's a matter of practice. But even on a theoretical level, on the level of principle, it's actually impossible to completely separate religion and state when it comes to law and legal practice. And a scholar called Winnie Sullivan has written about this in a couple of places. And just to put it just to give one straightforward example of how this doesn't work on the level of theory, let's say the American Supreme Court says that there has to be a complete protection of religion. The court then finds itself in a position of having to define religion and saying what is religion and what isn't religion, which then automatically brings it into the business of deciding how to define people's own practices and ways that they understand themselves. So there's something which is sort of self-undermining when the legal system tries to take itself out of interfering in religious affairs. It then automatically has to bring itself right back in again to define what is construed as religious and what is not.
Right, right. They can't get out of it.
Right.
But in contrast to the United States and many other countries, Israel's fundamental narrative is religious. It's biblical, the biblical promised land for the Jews and the story we are all familiar with. But even in ancient times, the Jewish kingdoms in Israel, the famous King Saul, David, Solomon, and the others, they had a political king's law that was separate from religious law. So tell us about that.
Yes, and that's, I'm not going to comment on what the actual law was in the time of David, because I'm not an ancient historian. So I don't have the competence really to talk about that. And the historical sources from the period itself are slim. But there's no question that the Hebrew Bible talks about when King Saul was appointed as king. The way that that worked was that the people came to the prophet Samuel and said, please appoint a king for us. And Samuel said, no, that would, you have to understand, if there is a king appointed over you, that king is going to have all kinds of rights as a king. He's going to be able to take away your property. He's going to be able to force you to work for him. He's going to be able to tax you. In other words, the king is going to have all of these legal rights, which the rest of you don't have, according to the rest of the laws of the Torah. So it did. And the prophet Samuel even refers to that using the term Mishpat HaMelech, the law of the king. So it does seem from the testimony of the Hebrew Bible itself that there is this kind of system of norms that apply to the ruling of the monarchy that don't apply in other kinds of political circumstances. And I think that the rabbis and the rabbinical literature understood ancient law and in fact the law of their own times in that same way. There's no question that the rabbis understood themselves as being governed by halakha. That goes without saying. But they also recognized that there were these other independent systems of law that were sort of recognized within the framework of the Torah, but were not the same either procedurally or in terms of the substance of their rules as halakha itself.
So if that is the case and was the case for centuries, how did the concept of an halachic state, a Jewish law state, Jewish religious law state, how did that develop?
So this is a really interesting story that I got completely engrossed in and ended up being like the central theme of the book. I think that when people look at Israel today, the term halachic state is very common, and it basically stands in for the sense that religious Jews in Israel, or at least some of the religious Jews in Israel, have this ideal of the state of Israel being governed by a Torah law, being governed by halakha. In other words, rather than the laws of the Knesset or the secular judges or whatever else, halakha should be in charge of the state. And I think that typically speaking, there are two common sort of explanations of how this ideology of the halakhic state came about. And I think that neither of them is quite right, and I offer a third. So I think the two common ideologies, the two common sort of histories of how this idea of the halakhic state arose are, on the one hand, very ancient, and on the other hand, very recent. So the very ancient position is that there's something intrinsic to religious ideas There's something about sort of the primordial essence of religious politics that, of course, would mean that any religious person would want their religious lord to be in charge of the state. And people that follow this line of thinking would point to all kinds of religious fundamentalist political movements around the world today and say, like, that's the true face of religion, so to speak. And the other position would say that that may not be true at all, but that there is a series of events that happened in Israel really quite recently that led to this sort of uptick of boldness of the religious Zionist community, which really was the 1967 war and the aftermath of that war and the sense of sort of religious euphoria of what was understood to be a miraculous victory, leading to the rise of the settler movement and the kind of emboldened religious nationalist sector of Israeli society, and becoming just more and more prominent. And I think that neither of those stories is exactly right, or at least is neither of them is the whole story. The first position, that there's something intrinsic to religion that leads religious people to need this kind of totalitarian political idea, I think is wrong for reasons which we already briefly discussed. And religious communities of all kinds, Jewish and others, have often recognized a kind of pluralistic legal idea, in the sense that there can be religious law for sure, but other kinds of law and other kinds of political authority are recognized alongside that religious law. So, for example, in the medieval Jewish community, there was, of course, halakha, but there were also lay courts that had judges who were not rabbis and did not judge by halakha, but made legislation and judged that legislation according to basically laws that were made up by the leaders of the community that was not halakhic law. And we could say similar things about Christian and Islamic communities in the Middle Ages and others that had some kind of legally pluralistic conception of legal authority. When it comes to the other position, that the idea of the halakhic state really got going in the 1970s, I think that that can't be discounted completely. Obviously, there was something that happened in religious Zionist society that changed things after the 67 war. But what I argue is that the real change, or another change at least, happened still earlier, at the end of the 1940s. And I say that really it was around 1948 that religious Zionist leaders converted their thinking from being more sort of pluralistic, more accommodationist, to the possibility of different legal regimes all sitting side by side happily in one state, religious norms and also democratic norms living side by side, to a more principled position, a more principled position that's called legal centralism, the idea that there's only room for one single legal system in the state. And for the religious leaders, that position was halakha.
And why do you think it came about or was embraced in 1948?
So that is a really interesting question. And I think that the answer to that question is extremely ironic, in my opinion. And I'll tell you why I think it's so ironic. The background to this is that before 1948, there were, of course, religious Zionist thinkers. And many of them were struggling with this question of what should be the legal regime if a Jewish state becomes established. So religious leaders writing in the 20s, the 30s, even well into the 40s were grappling with this question. And the reason why it was such a difficult question is because although they, of course, wanted halakha to have a prominent role in the state, they also recognized that halakha is... it's not straightforward to apply halakha in a democratic context. After all, certainly the Orthodox versions of halakha that they were embedded in discriminated in different ways, distinguished between men and women, between Jews and non-Jews. And they knew that in a democratic state, that obviously wasn't going to fly. So they had to come up with some kind of way that halakha could be important, but there was still room for a democratic law that that would work in the context they were living in. And the conclusion they came to was that this version of legal pluralism that Jewish society had adhered to for centuries, this sense that there can be two or more legal authorities within the same political territory, that's the idea that they alighted on. And I think it was very natural for them to think in those terms. They thought of Israel almost as a kind of continuation of the medieval kahal or kahila. So the idea was that there would be two systems of law that had authority in the state of Israel. There would be halakha, and there would be halachic courts that people could go to if they wanted. But there would also be democratic legislation, and there would be secular courts that people could go to if they wanted. In other words, there'd be a sort of dual system of laws. And that was that idea was proposed in different forms by various thinkers in the 20s through to the 40s. And it was only at the end of the 40s that a few really key people came along and sort of dashed that idea and nixed it entirely. And the people I have in mind, really the main character that I focus on, is Rabbi Yitzhak Isaac Halevi Herzog, who was Israel's first Ashkenazic chief rabbi, but also Rabbi Meir Berlin Bar Ilan, who was at the time really this sort of senior figure, both in age and also in authority in the religious Zionist movement. And both of these figures at the end of the 40s said that idea of a dual legal system, of these kind of parallel legal systems, one next to the other, is unacceptable to them. And they both said it has to be that there is only one legal system in this country, and that legal system is halakha. And they set about trying to put this into practice in very practical terms. They collected committees of rabbis and set them the task of writing law books, modern law books, that contained in them halachic laws. So their idea was, you know, if nowadays, if you go to law school, there are law books which contain the statutes of the state, and you have to study them. And if you're a judge, those are the books in your library that you refer to when you make judgments. And these people, Herzog, Bar-Ilan, and others, had in mind that there would be law books exactly like that for the state of Israel, but the laws in them would be halakha. And the committees that they set up, they tasked them with basically translating halakha into something that looked more like a modern law, but actually had exactly the same norms as the halakhic system. So they were very practically minded about this. And the real question then, and this is the question that you asked me a few moments ago, the real question is, why did this change? And what happened so abruptly at the end of the 40s that led to this turnaround? And the question is even deeper than the question of why did the change happen, when we recognize that actually people like Herzog and Bar-Ilan, who set themselves the task of creating a halachic system, an exclusively halachic system for the state, actually created all kinds of problems for themselves. Because halacha, first of all, has these aspects to it which, at the very least, are in tension with democracy. And everybody knew that the state of Israel was going to be a democratic state. The UN had insisted on that. It was part of the vote in November 1947. And, of course, the overwhelming majority of Zionist leaders at the time were not religious Zionists, but were secular, sometimes even militantly so. So there were all these kinds of problems that if you insist on having halakha as an exclusive law, you then set yourself the challenge of how do you account for these tensions with democracy? And moreover, how do you account for all kinds of questions that halakha hasn't really dealt with in the past many, many centuries, because halakha has never been the law of a state before, certainly not a modern state. So this really deepens the question of why it is that this shift was made in religious Zionist society from this more pluralistic model to an insistence on this centralist model. The reason why I think that happened, and this is one of the, this is where I come to what I refer to as a deep irony, is this. Herzog and Bar-Ilan and the other people that I talk about in my book argued that the reason that they needed halakha to be the exclusive law of a Jewish state was because having other laws, having a secular law instead of halachic law in governing the state of Israel would be, in their terms, a kind of desecration of God. One of them talked about it being writing a divorce document with God. It was a complete abandonment, in other words, of the religious ideal. They thought, why should we go and sort of appeal to all, why should we go and apply over ourselves all of these secular laws when we have the perfect divine law right here? We should just apply it. And so, in other words, they thought that unless they did this, it would be an abandonment of God. But the irony is that the very idea that there should be in a state a single, exclusive, centralized, hierarchically organized body of law which governs all aspects of legal authority in the state and governs all citizens in the state, whether they are Jewish or not, that idea is very, very foreign to the Jewish tradition. There may be strands of it here and there, but by and large, it's absent from the Jewish tradition. And where they got this idea from is modern European Christian and post-Christian legal theory. It's that tradition that argues that a state, a territory with borders, should have a single legal regime that applies to all its citizens. So the irony is that while they were arguing for halakha being the exclusive law of the state, because if not, it would be abandoning the Jewish tradition, in fact, the very idea, the very assertion that a state should have a single centralized system of law is itself borrowed from, itself shares assumptions with the European legal theory that they were claiming to be getting away from.
It is ironic. And I was also surprised to learn in your book that the institution of the chief rabbinate and the rabbinical court system that it oversees is a modern invention with no precedent in Jewish history, that in fact, it was an invention of the British Empire that was originally resisted by many rabbis. Tell us about how that came about.
Yes, that is a staggering fact for given the centrality of the chief rabbinate in the thinking of many religious Jewish Israelis today. But that is indeed the case. The idea of the rabbinate as a whole, of course, wasn't invented by the British. There have been rabbis, you know, obviously for a very long time. Since ancient times, and in Mandate Palestine, and before that in Ottoman Palestine, there were of course rabbis and rabbinic courts and rabbinic authorities that were there all along. What the British did do, though, was sort of invent and impose the idea of a centralized and hierarchically organized rabbinate. And what I mean by this, and by the way, in doing this, the British were not doing something sort of special for the Jews in Mandate Palestine. And they did this basically everywhere that they had colonies. It was a very common practice in British colonial rule that the native legal systems in whichever place would be kept intact, but would just be sort of reorganized to so that they could be fit into British ideas of legal organization and legal structures. So, for example, when it came to Mandate Palestine, the British came in and said, "Look, the Jews under Ottoman rule and for a really long time have had their, certainly their personal status laws of marriage, divorce, and so on, been governed by halakha and been judged by rabbis." And the British said, "We don't want to change that. But we do want to have what the British said that they did want to have what they considered to be sort of modern and appropriate procedures." So this included a few things. It included, first of all, the principle that there should be an appeals system within the rabbinical courts. Now, with very few exceptions and dubious exceptions at that, there's been no history in all of the history of halakha, there's been almost no history of, almost no examples of a court of appeals of halakha. Basically, if a rabbinical court rules X, then X stands, and there's very little recourse to overturning that. But the British believed that proper legal procedure needed to have an appeals court. And so the rabbinical court of Jerusalem, which was previously just another regional rabbinical court, no different from the one in Jaffa or from any of the other ones in the country, was turned into a court of appeals and had this special standing that the British required. And the British also insisted that the rabbinical courts would have all of these rules of procedure, that the decisions handed down by the rabbinical court should be written out in a proper sort of legal format, which is something which the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, explicitly says is not required by rabbinical courts. So in other words, the rabbinical courts pre-existed the British, but the British insisted that although they didn't want to take authority away from the rabbinical courts, they did want to impose this kind of structure on them, raising up the court in Jerusalem to have the status of a court of appeals, requiring all of these rules of procedure and so on, and setting up the structure of the rabbinate as we know it today. And exactly as you said, it was resisted at the time. Not surprisingly, the regional rabbinical courts, if the court in Jerusalem wrote to them and said, "Hey, we need your notes on this case because we're reviewing it with the possibility of overturning your verdict." Very commonly, the answer came back. Who on earth are you to overturn our ruling? That's not a halachic position. We've been an independent court since time immemorial. But eventually, this became ingrained also in religious society, and its origins with the British Empire, I think, today have largely been forgotten.
Yes, well, I didn't know about it. So how did the institution of the chief rabbinate change from being the preserve of religious Zionist rabbis to being totally dominated by the ultra-Orthodox today?
Yes, that is a pretty important question, especially the waters are muddied a little bit because our definitions of what is religious Zionist versus ultra-Orthodox, those categories sometimes sort of merge one into the other. So for example, you take a personality like Isaac Herzog, who was a very, very worldly, cosmopolitan person he had a PhD from a secular university and so on. But at the same time, I think many of his religious positions would seem relatively, well, not all of them, but some of them would seem relatively uncompromising by contrast to some of the more kind of progressive Orthodox positions today. In other words, things change. But you're right. There's definitely been a shift in the center of gravity of the ideological position of the chief rabbinate. And I think by and large, it is less explicitly Zionist in its ideology than it was 50 years ago. The dynamics by which that happened are a little bit beyond the scope of the book that I wrote.
Okay. Well, even given the somewhat fuzzy boundaries of the idea of religious Zionists, what would you say are their criticisms of the Israeli Supreme Court, the secular Supreme Court today?
Yes, so this is a very, very interesting. Bezalel Smotrich, who is, I would say, still a rising political figure on the religious right in Israel, just last year, in one of the endless election cycles that Israel had, made the play for becoming the Minister of Justice in a new government. And he said that why he thinks he should be Minister of Justice is that he wants to establish Torah law in Israel. And then somebody said, "But so are you arguing for a halachic state?" And he says, actually, the real halachic state is the halachic state of Barak and the whole Barak court. And what he meant by that was, you, the questioner, think that you're claiming that the halakhic state is this kind of sort of totalitarian, uncompromising legal regime. But actually, says Smotrich, he thinks that the real uncompromising, unaccountable, anti-democratic legal regime is that of the sort of progressive Israeli Supreme Court under Barak about coming up to sort of 15, 20 years ago now.
Right.
And that began. So the criticism there is actually quite an interesting one, which is saying, don't look at the difference between the substance of the laws. Yes, I want halakha, you want this, in terms of the actual norms that we each want. Look at the structures. And he says, you claim to have this liberal democratic society, but actually it is sort of totalitarian in its own way. Now, and that, by the way, is a phenomenon that we see not just in Israel but in other countries too. So, just coming back, for example, to the American example, here too, one of the many divisions between politics on the left and the right is the question of the place of the Supreme Court and what some people see as judges who are holding up people's liberal rights according to the Constitution, others see as the unelected, anti-democratic judges legislating from the bench. So this is an interesting parallel between the two countries there again.
That's right. So as you point out, religious Zionists are not a monolith. Tell us about the views of Yeshayahu Leibowitz about the roles of religion and the state in Israel.
Yes, so he is one of the most fascinating thinkers on this topic. And his position on religion is that it is essentially not just unpolitical, but in a sense anti-political. And what I mean by that is that for Leibowitz, the purpose of religion is to critique political authority and to critique the state. The state is a body that has the monopoly or claims for itself the monopoly on violence. The state can restrict people's liberties. The state can do all kinds of things that that might be dubious or questionable. And religion, the goal of religion or Jewish religion is to say that the ultimate authority is not the state, but God, that there's something outside of and beyond and transcending the state that is the true source of authority ultimately. And why that's a powerful position for him is that it means that religion can critique the failings of the state and its excesses, its potential for overstepping the bounds in terms of violence and affecting the rights of other people and so on. In that respect, religion is a kind of critical position because it keeps itself apart from politics. It creates for itself the possibility of critiquing politics and the excesses of the state. I think that's a very powerful position. What it means though is that religion can't play a more integrated role in political life. I'm not saying that that is a bad thing necessarily, but I do think that for many religious people, religious Jews in Israel today, and religious people in other countries around the world of whatever religious position, and there's this feeling that religion can't just stand apart from and critique, but it must sort of play a role that's a little bit more integrated into political society. So I think Leibowitz has a very powerful position as a critique. And by the way, there's a long tradition in the Jewish tradition of that kind of understanding of religion as standing apart. In a sense, it goes back to the prophetic traditions of the Hebrew Bible. And in more modern times, people like Martin Buber talked about theocracy as a way of criticizing the worst attributes of the modern state. But it does have this downside that it raises the question of how then a religious person is expected to participate in political life exactly.
Yes, and many writers have pointed out that once politics and religion get too close, it is to their mutual detriment. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Recently, a prominent Israeli jurist, Ruth Gavison, passed away.
Yes.
She was a secular person herself, but about 20 years ago, she and Rabbi Yaakov Maidan wrote a very significant document together about a compromise on the tension between religion and state, about what the principles were on each side and how they can coexist in harmony in Israel. Whatever happened to that document and that work?
Yes, that was a wonderful document. And it was not only a wonderful document, but I think a wonderful moment of two people who came from very different backgrounds, had very different ideological positions, but were really treating each other with an openness and with a sense of believing in the good faith of the other party. And the document was a really interesting product of what might come about in the sense of a compromise between these two positions. I think, honestly, that what happened to it was the Second Intifada, was the breakdown of Oslo, was subsequently the Hitnetkut, the very contentious moment in which the state of Israel pulled out of Gaza. I think that that document was written in a moment where, you know, of a kind of Rabin era where compromise seemed possible, peace seemed possible, change seemed possible. And then suddenly those doors started to close and positions became hardened and sectors of society became further from each other and more suspicious of each other and less open to each other. And that's unfortunately a trend that has only continued in recent years. So I think it was a document that came out of a particular moment of promise. But one of the casualties of subsequent history was the failure to act on it.
Hmm. And so, in your view, what is the best way to balance religion and law, religion and state?
That is the million-dollar question, or the 400 million shekel question. or whatever the exchange rate happens to be at the moment. That's really the question, and I'm going to give you an answer, and I already sense that it's going to be unsatisfactory, but nonetheless, I'm sticking with it. And that answer is that there is no one answer, and there is no, and I mean that in two senses. First of all, that there is no one answer in the sense of a kind of formula of relationships between religious and secular politics that can be applied in every context, whether it be, you know, every country or every period of time. In other words, the answer in America might be, and I'm certain is, different from the answer in Israel or in Iraq or in Ireland and so on. So there is no one answer in the sense that different societies will have different dynamics, different histories, and therefore different answers to that question. But the other answer is that the other thing I mean by there's no one answer is that there can't be a permanent resolution to this. I honestly believe that it will be certainly extremely difficult and potentially impossible to come up with a document of principles that can be put into place and say, okay, now this is the answer to our question when it comes to Israel, and we'll just have this way going forward for the next, you know, however many centuries. I think that's because societies are dynamic, because the borders between the sectors of society are porous, because there's intellectual exchange, because there are external political developments that shunt things in one direction or another. The question of the relationship between these two things is never going to be fixed. It's always going to be a negotiation. It's going to be a negotiation between values, between different sectors of society, between their interests and so on. if there's going to be, if there is something which I think can be some kind of solution, it's not in terms of, look, here are my three ideas for how things can change for the better in practice, but rather in attitude. I think right now, because of the tremendous history of tensions and clashes and very, very sort of for good reason, high running tempers between people in different camps, it's just very, very difficult for people to talk to each other. And I think what one of the things that could really help is a recognition, like a genuine belief that people who disagree with you may be doing it for genuine reasons. That doesn't mean that you agree with them. It doesn't mean that you have to go along with what they say. And it certainly doesn't mean that you have to adopt their values. But rather, rather instead of saying that person is a bad faith actor, that person is really just after power and all of this religion or secular discourse is just a kind of masking for that, just to come with an openness to the possibility that people have deep feelings, passions, commitments, fears often that are sometimes expressed in political or religious language. Now, that's not to say that there aren't just power-hungry people acting in bad faith, narcissists, sociopaths. These people most certainly exist. But I think by and large, that's not what we're dealing with when we look at, the bulk of people. So that's not really a solution for, a practical answer. But it's a question of a sort of attitude that may help things. And then the last thing No, please go ahead.
No, you take complete your thought, please.
Okay, so just the last point on this is that one of the things that I've really tried to show in my book is that even when you have two positions that appear to be fundamentally opposed to each other, they can have under the surface all kinds of shared assumptions. So just to sort of pad that out with an example in practice, I think that when it comes to the clash between religious and secular approaches to legal authority in the state of Israel, so should it be a secular democracy or should it be a halachic state, these appear to be just fundamentally opposed positions. But underlying those positions is a similarity, which is that there is a belief that a state should have a single system of law in a single legal hierarchy, which should be applied to all the citizens in that state. And that's not something that goes without saying. Like I said, that earlier, that's not something that was around for a long time in the Jewish tradition. So even behind very apparently opposed positions, there can be all kinds of similarities, and that can lead to room for conversation and discussion also.
Well, I think you have some good advice there. And it sounds like the Gavison-Maidan model of mutual respect, despite very different worldviews, is one that would be worth revisiting. Alexander, you've given us a lot to think about, and I'm going to let you go soon. But first, I want to hear about what you're working on now.
Oh, thank you for asking. That's a really nice question. So I'm working on a couple of projects at the moment. One of them is a sort of an other branch of the stuff that we've been talking about now, which is basically a sort of legal history of the Kibbutz Harati, the religious kibbutz movement. Because a lot of the historical trends that we discussed today, which are true of religious Zionist society as a whole, were not true of the religious kibbutz movement, certainly in its early years, in the sort of 40s, 50s, and 60s. And there's all kinds of fascinating legal theory that they bring to this. And, the last question you asked me is, what are ways that we could think differently in the future or more productively in the future? I think that some of the thinking that they had and other characters at the same time, especially some Sephardi rabbis in those years, could be really, really productive and interesting. So that's one project. And the other project I'm working on right now is a project about Galut, the idea of Galut, the idea of Jewish exile, and specifically the idea of Jewish exile as it has played out in the modern imagination of Jews and of others, how it plays into questions of creativity, the diasporic imagination, comparative perspectives between Jewish ideas of the diaspora and other communities' ideas of the diaspora, for example, the African-American diaspora and so on. So Galut is the thing for me, for my current scholarship as well.
Wow, both are very interesting topics. And I'll stay tuned and look forward to see what emerges from your work.
Thanks so much, Renee. Thank you.
Alexander, thank you for your important work in this book and for being on the show today.
It was absolutely a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Take care. And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikoff.